the way at the end. Last parak, pasuk kaf gimel. Last week we saw the interesting plot that the Sanhedrin devised of providing wives for Shevet Binyamin, with the idea being to enable them to rebuild. In order to rejuvenate, to be able to get the Shevet, recreate the Shevet. So now, Vayasu Chen Bnei Binyamin. The children of Binyamin did so. Vayis'u nashim l'mispalom min ha'mecholo lois asher gazalu. And they married women according to their number. That is, we stressed last week, the Sanhedrin did not give a license for a free-for-all. Each man takes one wife from the dancing girls that they had stolen. Once again, we just refer briefly to last week where we explained stolen means without the parents' consent, but without the consent of the girls themselves, the whole thing would have had no validity. So the stealing was in the sense that they wooed the girls and swept them quite literally off their feet and took them as wives. Now, Vayelchu Vayashuva al Nachalasa, they went back. They returned to their estate, meaning for these last few months they hadn't been in their estate. They'd been hiding out in a cave. Now they're coming back to their home, their Shevet Binyamin territory, which at this point was ground zero. They had been totaled, completely destroyed. And it was left desolate. Now they're coming back. Vayivnu es ha'arim, and they built the cities. Vayishvu bahem, and they settled there. Now, we come to the next pasuk, which superficially sounds like it doesn't have much significance, but it actually has a lot of significance. First, let's just read the pasuk. Vayisalchu misham bnei Yisrael vayisahi. So all the people of Yisrael left at that point, ish lishivtoi lemishpachtoi. Each man went back to his tribe, to his family. Vayetzu misham ish linachalosai. And each man went back to his estate. Any major significance there? Doesn't sound okay, pretty part of the pasuk. But no, this pasuk also gives us a lot of perspective on what was going on here. They first went home now? The war ended 4 months ago. Why'd they first go home now? Everybody was still hanging around. So, the Mefarshim say that just as we saw that at the time when they gathered to take action against what had happened, they declared nobody is going home until we figure out what should be done. Now, when they had reached the conclusion, when they saw that now they have to figure out what can they do to get Binyamin back on their feet, it was the same thing. Everybody felt personal responsibility. Nobody went home until the solution was carried out. People stayed away from their families for another 4 months. The battle itself didn't take nearly as long. The whole story in the beginning was an issue of short time. And now, they're waiting for 4 months to see how this is going to happen. What's that? So this is part of the point. The Sanhedrin were dealing with it. And people didn't even know how the Sanhedrin were dealing with it. But there was that feeling of, we bear responsibility for this. We can't just go back to normal life until this is rectified. Even though, practically speaking, they couldn't do anything about it. On an analogy of a little more recent times, there was a big fire in the city of Brisk, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was working very hard. Many of the families, you know, in the old Polish towns, when there was a fire, houses went in a matter of, it was all wooden building very quickly. So many people overnight were suddenly without homes, and many people moved into the shul, etc. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was working very hard to find solutions for these families. All throughout that period, he slept on the floor. Slept on the floor. Why? Because he said, until they're set up, I need to suffer along with them. I can't be settled while they're not. So this is right. They weren't even helping anything by being there. But they were helping by... I moved into the shul. They weren't even they weren't helping anything by being there. They were helping by participating in the situation. This is an end in and of itself. They bore the problem. They bore the pain of the problem. This is one of the greatest virtues that we're taught as Jews. Noisei ba'olim chaver. To hurt along with somebody else. And to actually suffer on the practical level. Now, another point that the Mefarshim bring out, and this point is going to sound a little less noble after the previous point we just brought out, but this is also very, very important in understanding the nature of the people at the time. Picture, once again, the superficial understanding, people read the story, you know, you read through the Psukim just without really analyzing the story carefully. Everybody points at the whole story of Telegesh Begiva as the picture of anarchy, free-for-all, just the mob mentality, etc. But now, picture in a realistic way. I'm sorry, you're going to have to forgive me, it's unusual when my wife calls me. Hello. I know this way. That's not a usual occurrence. Okay. you have to try to picture it in realistic terms. Let's say we're just talking about a barbaric, uncivilized bunch. And therefore, yeah, their response when something doesn't sit well with them, well, that itself is a problem. Why shouldn't this sit well with them if that's their profile? But, whatever it is, something doesn't sit well with them, the response is go wipe everybody out. What should be the natural continuation of the story? Now there's a whole territory that's empty. The natural situation of the story is plundering. People go capture territories. No, nobody's touching. Nobody's touching. At the end, there are 600 people left from Binyamin. Everybody stands back as that handful of people goes now to settle the entire territory of Shevet Binyamin. Nobody is trying to usurp any land, to take anything. Everybody's just standing back. Once again, you have to note this. The Metzudas points this out. The Metzudas says that's the point that the Pasuk is bringing across here. What sort of people we're talking about? And now the Navi concludes with the statement that has come up a few times throughout the story, "Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael." In those days, there was no king in Israel. Ish hayashar be'einov ya'aseh. Each man did what was right in his eyes. So the Metzudas views this pasuk as a direct continuation of the previous one. The pasuk is bringing out there was no king there. It would have been difficult to enforce masses piling onto the land and people starting to grab, but yet, even though there was no king, nothing of this sort happened. Why? Because people did what was right in their eyes. This is usually taken in a negative sense. Everybody did what they wanted. That's not what the pasuk says, as we've stressed time and time again. People did what was right in their eyes, quite literally, which means people lived according to their conscience, the dictate of their conscience, according to their sensitivities. And therefore, you know why? Even though there was no king, how come nobody went to take over some of that territory? Because even though there was no king, people lived according to what was right in their eyes. Now certainly, a gezeira? No, here we're talking about there was no, Binyamin was still around. They were talking about, there was a need to make a gezeira, because when you wipe out a goyish city, you're allowed to plunder. Right? But here, Binyamin is still around. Nobody was mafkir their territory. So, this is the point. Now, we'll stress that it goes in both directions. There's two sides to the coin here. The Mefarshim say this too. The fact that there was no king in those days, what enabled these events to happen in the first place? Yes, the story of Pelegesh Begiva, the story of Micha, these were the results of the fact that there was no king. But at the same time, It's like we stressed many times. This is exactly the point. Yes, there was no king. And yes, it was possible for all kinds of problems to develop. And problems did develop. But the point is that how many problems developed? In a general way, like we said, this was a period of 400 years in which the Jewish people lived with the reality of Hashem hu Malkichem. Each person was responsible for himself to live up to the standards that Hashem set. Sure that things could go wrong. That's what made this period so great. And things did go wrong. But once again, these were isolated incidents here and there. In a general way, the nature of the people at that time is as we're seeing here. So this certainly gives us some perspective on this story. And now, I really want to take a step back as we're really concluding this sefer to give a little bit more of a general perspective on the story we've just seen on the period in general. And these are points that we mention every so often as we're going through Nach, but it's important to stress them again and again, because otherwise things appear confusing. So first of all, we can wish ourselves Mazel Tov. It's been close to a year. We concluded Sefer Shoftim Mezuz Hashem, and we'll celebrate in the Purim spirit with Hamantashen that I personally recommend. I've tasted a whole bunch beforehand. So compliments of, like I said, a secret person sitting on the other side of the Mechitza, and we'll leave it at that. Okay. So now, we have to understand, we go through Nach, you see the Tanakh, we'll say, you see harsh approaches. Now we're going to split that into two levels. Harsh approach on the part of Hashem. Hashem deals harshly with the Jewish people. And what we're seeing now, which is much more unusual, but we're seeing that here in a very big way, is decisions on the part of the Jewish people themselves, which appear very harsh. So, let's move from one to the other, just to put this into proper perspective. Let's start with the first part of it, Hashem. We see throughout the Midbar, throughout the period of the Midbar, that Hashem has very, very tough demands. And seeing here also that Sanhedrin did this in the understanding that this was what Hashem wanted. We already saw earlier all kinds of different incidents where there was the tiniest slip and major repercussions. Here it wasn't such a tiny slip. But we see such things. So let's understand this properly. Let's understand this properly. We have to understand what the Jewish people are. What the Jewish people are. I want to draw on an analogy. One of the famous generals of American history is a general by the name of General Tom Thumb. Heard of him? General Tom Thumb. Okay? Now, did he go down in history because of his unbelievable military feats? Or because of the comical figure he was? Now, I saw some pictures of him. You see him standing in his full military, again, in case anybody who doesn't know, Tom Thumb was a very famous midget. And I assume this was a manifestation of the lack of sensitivity in those times, but they used him as a circus figure. And he became world famous. And he was always presented as a general. You see the pictures, some of the pictures of him, how see him in full regalia, and you see how he plays the part well. You see him looking very, you know, he's got his sword, he's got the whole thing, and he's standing like this, like a hush of a general, and there are people saluting to him. And you know, as he gets out of his coach, he had a tiny little coach like this big, and as he steps out of his coach in his full military regalia, and there are people there, you know, like this, who are about three times his height, and there's even a picture of him standing, you see a colonel standing like this, and the general is standing on his hand, right, with a very arrogant general-like look on his face, and the colonel has this submissive look. He's holding him like this. Now, I was looking at these pictures, and I was analyzing them. It was very interesting. And I said, there's two possibilities of what's going on here, and both are probably true to an extent. A, he played his part well. Right? Played his part well. Okay? B, and I'm sure that there's truth to this also, even though, you know, I don't know it for a fact, obviously, that the man actually enjoyed the moment, in the sense of, now he's getting out of his coach, creating a sensation. Everybody's standing there and saluting. And him in his nice general's regalia. It was a nice feeling. It's a nice feeling. So now, yes, where he goes, he is treated like the greatest of generals. Maybe even more, because again, this is the show business. Where he goes, he gets the respect, again, externally, okay? Never mind right now what people are thinking. The truth is they're thinking that even when they're really giving respect to people. But whatever it is, never mind what people are thinking there. He is experiencing what the greatest of generals experience. All the pomp, right? Just, there's a whole crowd watching and rolling with laughter. Forget about that for a minute. When he steps out of a coach, there's a whole line of people standing and saluting. And he is dressed in the, you know, top-notch uniforms. The sword, you see in his other picture of him standing with the sword. You know, you see these pictures of like these famous generals standing, like, you know, like that. And the picture of him standing with the sword like that. So kind of like a little a long toothpick. So what's my point? My point is that at the end of the day, let's say he enjoyed the moment. Did he live with the same feeling that, let's say, I don't know, who's a really great general in history, could be one of the biggest names in the last 200 years? Napoleon, I don't know. Huh? Yo-Yo. Okay, well, Yo-Yo had a different mentality. But let's say Napoleon or someone along those lines, celebrated general. Did he live with that same feeling of happiness and fulfillment? A general, you know, let's say Napoleon, before he was an emperor, like when he was still Bonaparte, is that how you pronounce it? Right? So, when he walked, you know, past that line of saluting soldiers, it wasn't just that he was enjoying the moment of the soldiers saluting. He was enjoying the accomplishments and the achievements that brought him to this time. His sense of fulfillment was an ongoing phenomenon. It wasn't something that he enjoyed for the moment. When Tom Thumb went home to his circus tent, he was going to sleep at night. He might have enjoyed the memory of the moment, but was he still filled with that feeling of greatness? Enjoy it at the moment and then it goes away. Real happiness, true happiness, is the happiness that comes from achievement and success. Everything else is fleeting physical pleasures. This is what we call the tivus of this world. And that's why they don't make people happy. What makes people happy? One simple example of material, real happiness is nachas. Right? Nachas from children. What's nachas from children? Nachas from children is the result of ongoing investment, right? It's the feeling of accomplishment, of achievement, that stays with a person for years afterwards. It's something ongoing. None of the tithes of this world provide you with something that lasts for more than a moment. This really is the essence of what Hashem wanted to grant the Jewish people. And then we ask, why couldn't we just go to Olam Haba straight, without going through this world? Hashem created us in order to give us the biggest chesed possible. Why couldn't we go straight to Olam Haba? Couldn't give us that? Why do you have to make us work for it? And the answer is that it would be the difference between these two different types of pleasures. One would be a fleeting pleasure that you might have someone sustaining the whole time, but it's not real. It's not deep. Even if today we can enjoy it, the neshama, which is made out of the most perfect substance there is, can't even define it as substance, can't enjoy something that isn't the real thing. Hashem set us up in order to bring us to the, how do you say, pinnacle, I don't know, how do you say it? Pinnacle of what existence could possibly create. And that was in order to enjoy eternal bliss of our achievement. Of our achievement. What was that achievement? Hashem created the Jewish people in order to be not another nation who do mitzvahs. Hashem created the Jewish people in order to be the most amazing and astounding phenomenon ever created. We learned that in Kuzari lately. And Hashem identifies himself as Elokei Yisrael, the God of the Jewish people. Not as Elokei Hashemesh. He's not the God of the sun. Doesn't identify himself as the God of the sun, even though he created the sun. Because the Jewish people are a much more amazing phenomenon. Why? Because the Jewish people bring out greatness that most people would consider beyond human capability. But Hashem knows the kriches that He put in to the Jewish people. And He's saying, yes, I can make out of the Jewish people something, an entity that is more amazing than the greatest natural phenomena that exists. This, if He wants to, this is the way it's put. Sounds strange to put it this way, but this is the way it's put in our sources. It's not my way of putting it. When Hashem wants to show off to the Malachim His capability, He doesn't point at the sun and the moon. He points at the Jewish people and then look how they function. In other words, what Hashem was doing was taking a human race, a human people, and personally, kiviyachol, personally manufacturing them into the greatness that He envisioned. This is the story of Hashem's relationship with the Jewish people, in a nutshell. Now, this really, we've said this time and time again, so we're not going to harp on the point too much right now, but this really is the story of the Jewish people in the Midbar. Hashem was working them very hard. It was a rigorous training camp. That was what was going on in the Midbar. A rigorous training camp to raise them to levels that people would say is unrealistic for human beings. And He drove them and drove them and drove them very hard. Now, the Jewish people were made to experience, yet there in this world, the Kuzri brings this point out also, it was not just a boot camp, but the Jewish people already experiencing then what it means to be brought up to Hashem's circle, to be brought into Hashem's realm. Because Ari says that people at that time didn't have to believe in Olam Haba because they experienced it in this world. They already were able to access the feelings of Olam Haba because of the reality they lived in. This you don't see stressed in the Chumash time and time again. It is certainly explicit in the Chumash, but it's not being harped on. But the reality that they were living with was a reality of Olam Haba. Being close to the Shekhinah is a reality that's so thrilling, we never experienced it. It's so thrilling that it fills a person's whole life with that feeling of exhilaration. The way the Kuzari puts it is, in those days when there was Nevuah, then again, we picture Nevuah, Hashem had to get a message across, so He tapped someone on the shoulder and gave him a message. Nevuah was entering Olam Haba. Connecting with Hashem in a direct and open way was Olam Haba in this world. Now, it was such an intense experience, the Kuzari says, that forget the person who got the Nevuah. Someone who observed a Navi prophesying was a changed person for the rest of his life. It made such an impact on you. Seeing somebody going through that experience was such an experience in and of itself that it changed a person for the rest of his life. Because Ari says, a person who saw a Navi prophesying lost his interest in the physical pleasures for the rest of his life. People were seeing that on a regular basis. How did they mess up? If so, oh, okay, we're learning now. You see, it's always possible. As great as the spiritual level is, Hashem raises the Yitzhara to that level. But that's not our point right now. Now, even people who did not experience the world were living with a level of bliss that was unequal. The reality of the Jewish people at that time was amazing. Say, for example, the feeling that you see Hashem interacting with you on a regular basis. Nevuah was the epitome of it, but it didn't have to be Nevuah. People could be living with an open, tangible relationship with Hashem, which was not an issue that you had to work so hard on sensing a little bit like we do today. I'll give an example. The military successes of the Jewish people are given a lot of weight in Tanakh. Why? Because we're just as strong as any of them? That's not the point. What the experience is like when you go out to battle and you see, as you're approaching, that the enemy is starting to drop like flies before anybody even did anything. You sense Hashem, the Shekhinah is there, right, in front of you, just knocking the enemy down. Hashem tells you to go out to battle. And in fact, we see in the way, you might remember, we learned back earlier in Shoftim, that by Devira, Hashem tells Devira, there's the whole army of Sisera, army of hundreds of thousands, who are dominating Eretz Yisrael. She tells Barak a message from Hashem. Hashem wants you to go fight Sisera. Get an army together. I think the number that of soldiers that he had was 24,000, if I remember correctly. Was it 10,000? 10,000. 10,000. You see in the psukim there that they didn't even have proper weapons. Right? Gets together a ragtag team. A bunch of rebbes come out of Cheder. Right? Gets together a ragtag team. and he's camped on one mountain. Sisera and his army of hundreds of thousands are camped, are approaching. And then the virus says all of a sudden, now Barak is okay because the virus is with him and he knows that he has Hashem's promise that he's going to win. How does the war actually play out? So, okay, there's a whole description of how Hashem just confounds the whole army of Sisera, but the way it's described in the Navi is, all of a sudden, right, Barak is on the top of a mountain, Sisera is at the bottom with his hundreds of thousands, and all of a sudden the virus says, Kum! All of a sudden says, Barak, you're missing the opportunity. The war has already started. Rush out quickly. So Hashem is already out there fighting. And your army is still on top of the mountain. It's not going to look good if they're all dead before the army even got there. That's the way it's expressed in the Navi. So Barak goes rushing down in order to get there while the war is still going on. The army has to show up before the war is over. Right? So this is what happens. Now that's war. That was the way it worked in the beginning. You saw Hashem fighting with you, right? Also on the material level, just on the material of everyday life, the things that we see described of the quality of the fruits in Eretz Yisrael, etc. So we, again, you take this as, okay, they're great. They had grapes the size of watermelon. Big deal. I mean, what? Okay, we have watermelons that size. No, you have to realize what the point is. When you saw your spiritual efforts reflected in the crops of your field, that was like a stroke on the cheek from Hashem. When you saw, I was working harder this year at Shemiras Halashin, I need this, that. And then, you went out and then you saw the wheat size of kidneys, this thing. That was a struggle. That was such a thrilling experience that people went out of their minds. You see Hashem personally coming and giving you his stamp of approval without coming onto the moon. This is what these people lived with. But what did it take to earn this? It took operating on a very, very high level, which they saw the rewards of their efforts. But this was not just something that Hashem provided incentive. Hashem enforced this. And therefore, there was a very strong discipline in place as well. The Jewish people were expected to be operating above a line that was unrealistic from the human perspective. But Hashem knew that they could do it. And this involved, yes, that closeness, that love, etc., that they experienced all the time. And it also involved a very strong discipline approach, which they were built for. In our generation today, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. People are not made out of the same stuff. I say this even when I see people sitting here, biyachas to myself, relative to myself. I'm not made out of the same stuff as people who are coming from a door or two before me. But we're not made out of the same stuff. The way Rav Pan put it was, normally, when you kasher, if you want to kasher a vessel, how's the ultimate way to kasher a vessel? You put it into a furnace. That is the epitome of kashering, right? Any impurities that it might have absorbed will be brought out when it's put into a furnace. Except, there's one vessel that you can't kasher in a furnace, a clay vessel, an earthenware vessel, it smashes in a furnace. So Rav Pam said, in earlier times you were able to kasher people in furnaces. Today we're all clay cheres. Today you can't deal with kids like that. Today you can't be mechanic that way. Because clay cheres in a furnace smash. I'll give one little anecdote to illustrate this point. Shalom Shvadron learned in the Chevron Yeshiva. He was one of the youngest Talmidim in the Chevron Yeshiva. He learned under the legend, the other story. He learned under the legendary Mashkiach of Leib Chasman. Leib Chasman was a master of developing people. So, Reb Shalom Shvadron was, again, the youngest boy in the yeshiva. I don't know how old he was, 14 or 15? 15. 13. And he was, at one point, something came up, a shaila in the tefillah, tachnun someday, tachnun if tishkir. And he was standing right near the chazan, and the chazan was unsure of what to do. So Shalom, the young Shalom Shvadron, told the chazan what to do. Okay? So after the tefillah, Reb Leib Chasman, the mashgiach, he got up and he said, oh, I see we have a new Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva. He said, will the new Rosh Yeshiva deign to take out a Mishneh Berurah Chelek Beis from the closet, from the bookshelf? Sean was already turning colors. He walks over to the bookshelf and he takes out a Mishneh Berurah Chelek Beis. And then Reb Leib said, now can we respectfully request of the new Rosh Yeshiva to open up to this and this page and this and this place? And with his shaking hands, he opens up to the page. And now he says, and now we request of the Honorable Rosh Yeshiva to read out loud. And Sholem Shvadron read out loud exactly the opposite of what he had just told the Chazan to do. So he was so humiliated, he just ran to his room. And he was there for like he stayed there for a day, didn't want to come out for a day or 2 days. Two weeks, I don't know. But ultimately, how did the story end? Reb Leib didn't come to hold his hand. Reb Leib walked into his room and he said, enough, you can go back to this medrash. Reb Sholem Shvadron's comment on this harsh story was, he says, these things turned us into the men we were. But a mashgiach who does that today is a murderer. That was Reb Sholem Shvadron's comment on the story. This is really the point that we're making here. Yes, Hashem was driving the Jewish people to levels of perfection, to levels of excellence that are beyond comprehension to people of our time. The Mordechai Gaon says that we don't have the concept of what the simplest of people were, what a child was in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. It's beyond our comprehension. And because they were living with a completely different reality. And the way Rabbi Avigdor Miller put it is, and this is really a Gemara, says that there's higher quality flax and lower quality flax. Higher quality flax, the more you beat it, the more pliable it becomes. The more expensive because of the time they put into beating it. The more time you put into beating it, you beat and beat and beat and beat, can't be beaten enough. The more you beat it, the more quality it becomes. Then there's the lower quality flax. You beat it a little bit, once you pass the line, it breaks apart. It falls apart. As Hashem squeezed and pressed and beat the most quality people in order to produce the most quality fabric. Or pressed very hard the quality grapes in order to produce the best wine possible. This was the story of the people of those generations. This was what was going on there. And yes, Hashem pushed hard because yes, if you're expecting people to constantly be operating at a level, which is like we said again, beyond human capability in natural terms, while there always is the Yetzirah pulling down. And not only that, but the whole world around is pulling down because this is completely unlike standards anywhere else. Yes, part of the approach of doing it was on the one hand, they saw what they were achieving by doing this, but on the other hand, yes, there was a very, very firm discipline set up in place. And there was very firm ways of enforcing this system. Because the stakes were very great. What was being achieved here was so great that it was well worth it. We already discussed last week how even if people lost their lives in this process through Hashem showing how even slight things in order to push them to even greater levels of perfection, when slight things were punished very, very harshly, epidemic of tens of thousands dying, was for the purpose of pushing them to even greater perfection, and it was worth it for the people who lost their lives in these processes. It was worth it for them because they served as part of Hashem's lesson to the Jewish people. This was the reality that they lived with in those days. Now, sorry. Okay. I just want to illustrate this in a couple of ways. I just want to illustrate this. Even you see it today. The concept of, yes, the Jewish people being, you might have heard me go through some of these examples, or go through them anyways, I have some ones. But the concept of the Jewish people living on a level that people would say can't really be. It can't be. Is there a round button here? Sorry, just a second. Give me a minute. But standards of morality. standards of morality in the Jewish people make a lot of sense. Are they realistic? In today's day and age, Jewish standards of morality are not realistic. I want to read a piece of the Rambam at the end of Hilchos Yisurei Bia. Sorry, just give me a minute. The Rambam says as follows. There is nothing, I'm reading from the Rambam at the end of the Halachas of Forbidden Relations. There is nothing in the entire Torah that is as difficult for the masses to keep away from as arayas. And the Chachamim say that when the Jewish people were commanded regarding arayas, they were so overwhelmed that they wept. How can we possibly live up to these standards? They complained about it. That's what the pasuk means when it says that they were all weeping. It's not the pshat. It's not the pshat that the Baruch HaMishpachos. It's not the pshat that they said, "Oh, we really want to do these things." That's not. That wasn't the point. That they were weeping because Hashem really expects this of us. This is impossible, and they were right. But Hashem can achieve the impossible, and when Hashem personally trains and shapes a people, those people can achieve the impossible. This is what the Jewish people are. Now, the Chachamim said that Gezel and Arayas, people naturally gravitate towards. They have a lust for them and they want it. And there is, you don't find anywhere in history, in any place or in any time, a community or a population that does not have problems of Pritzis ba'arayas. Therefore, a person has to take extra measures. And this, by the way, yes, the Jewish people took quite extreme measures, which people look at and they say, come on, does it really have to be that extreme? But, for example, among Jewish people, men and women don't touch each other. They don't touch each other at all if they're not immediate relatives. I think I've told you the story of the time when I was in a taxi with a Muslim taxi driver who, if everybody knows the story, I won't say it again. But some people are shaking their heads, so bear with me. I was in a taxi with a Muslim taxi driver in America. Not an Arab, an Indian, okay, but it was safe. But a Muslim taxi driver, we got to schmoozing about our religions, and he said, both of our religions don't allow relationships, you know. But, come on, in today's day and age, he like winked at me. I was 19 years old at the time, healthy boy, 19 years old at the time, and I said to him, from the age of about 10 or 11, I haven't touched a woman outside of my immediate family. So he looked at me like, oh, come on, man. Who are you kidding? He knew it couldn't be. He knew it couldn't be, and he was right. He knew it couldn't be, and he was right. Now, therefore, for example, right, a mashgiach of mine in yeshiva once went to the embassy. Today, it's everybody, you know, the offices, there are formal kinds of affairs, etc. Mashgiach of mine went to the embassy, met with a consular officer, we had to sit with her for a while, and she extended her hand. So he said, I can't shake your hand. He explained it very, so I can't shake your hand. We reserve any physical contact for our wives only. So she looked at him with tears in her eyes. She said, I'm jealous of your wives. I'm jealous of your wife. When my husband leaves the house, she said, I sometimes just worry. What's he doing? I'm jealous of your wife. So now, this applies for Yichud, and this applies to many of the measures that are taken in this area. Therefore, a person should train himself to constantly overcome his yetzer in these areas, to act with exceeding kedusha also in his thoughts, in order to save himself from these things. Be very careful of secluding yourself with the wrong woman, because that's one of the greatest causes. How much have the Jews protected themselves because of this concept called yichud? And people say, woman, you can't control yourself? No, we can't control ourselves. And anybody who says they can, look at their circles, right? In the non-Jewish circles, they say, this is disgusting. What, you can't trust yourself? Well, what's going on there? And what's going on among the people who do keep Yichud? So that's right, we can't control ourselves. And he says that the greatest of Chachamim were not embarrassed to tell their Talmidim, stick around when I'm with my daughter-in-law in order to keep an eye on me. One of the greatest Chachamim told his Talmidim. They acknowledged human weakness in order to be able to rise above it to levels that the rest of the world cannot consider conceivable. And why did he make a point of saying this? He wanted to teach his Talmidim. It's not great to say, I'm strong enough. Greatness is to be able to say, I know that I might not be strong enough, and therefore, I'm going to keep away. That's the greatness. You have people saying, you have to be strong enough to, ta ta ta. I'm sure you have to be strong enough, but are you? That question is not necessarily addressed. So, another example. I had a cousin who was called in for jury duty in a very grisly murder case. You know the story. And the person learns in the Kollel in South Fallsburg. All he knows is the route from his house to the Kollel. That's basically his exposure to murder and all the other, you know. And they were showing, they had pictures of the body and all those much terrible scenes. And he, after the first night or two, he couldn't sleep and he was going out. He went off to the judge after. He said, I just can't handle this. So the judge said to him, come on, you have TV. So he said, I don't. The judge looked at him, you what? I don't own a TV. I don't see these things. The judge was in shock. They verified it. So he exempted him. He said, due to excessive innocence. That was the exemption that he was given. Again, you're talking about people living in this world with everybody else and floating above it. They're floating above it. This is due to Hashem's training system. We talk about it as things of the past. We have to realize it's extant in our time as well. People who are floating above the reality of it. You have to realize that's also, you know, we saw the gathering of city fields. He said, Oizer Yisrael Begvura, Hashem gives Klal Yisrael the means to be able to have the strength to rise above things that pervade the entire world. He saw the gathering at City Field, where, I don't know what the numbers were, but thousands and thousands of Jews gathered together to hear, 50,000 Jews gathered together to hear the Rabbanim address the dangers of unfiltered internet. And I remember at the time, that there was the talk about how ridiculous it was and this and that. We were seeing another step in the process of Oizer Yisrael Bigbura. There's a reality that is taking over the entire world, a virtual reality called cyberspace, where basically most people have relocated to and spend their lives. And they were seeing another manifestation of that rising, getting together to rise above it, to be able to resist another slide. By living in, again, an unrealistic way. To live today without internet, without open internet, is something unrealistic. My wife has it every so often. She's on the phone with some operator or something, and they tell her to access it from the web. She said, we don't have internet. Just this week, she said to somebody, we don't have internet access. What do you mean? I mean that we don't have internet. What does that mean? I mean, that means that we don't have any internet in the house. Oh, really? Oh, okay, we'll try to figure something else out. Unrealistic, can't really be in today's day and age. And yet it could be. Yet it is. Or, if you want a much more recent example, where you see the discipline of the Torah. What were the numbers yesterday? There's a big machloikis, what the numbers were yesterday. We'll call it, they were confident enough to make the bracha of Baruch Chacham Arazim, which means that there were at least 600,000 people there. And there's 600,000 people protesting against something that they felt was hitting the essence of their being. The worst tragedy in the world as far as they were concerned. And the entire thing, there was no
excitement. No, nothing. It was a peaceful 2 hours, absolute decorum and order. Well, of course, the Jerusalem Post need to report that in some neighborhood near the rally, somebody burned some tires. No, it wasn't entirely peaceful. There was something. Yeah. And also that there was one guy who started up with some people and they sprayed him with pepper spray. So no. There was. Don't worry. The Jerusalem Post can sleep well at night. They can't. It's poking their eyes out. That's why they can't sleep well at night. But whatever it is. No. There were disturbances. Okay. 700,000 people demonstrating against something that, as far as they were concerned, was the worst thing in the world. They felt their entire existence was threatened. Such decorum, would that be anywhere else in the world? It's also a completely unrealistic, because we have to note this. You have to note the Kiddush Hashem. Again, they're not going to be focusing. Okay, they have to admit that it was peaceful. Everybody knows that if you have 3 Haredim somewhere, stones are thrown. What do you do with the fact that now there were 700,000? Well, it's a problem we'll be dealing with for a while. Okay, but whatever it is, this is again the point. Yes, all these things that we're seeing are the result of Hashem's training system. Today, we're back in a situation, not for the same fortunate reasons as then, for unfortunate reasons, that we are once again in a situation of Ish HaYoshev Ein Ov Yaseh. We don't have the Torah being forced in the way it was then. But yet the Jewish people, as much as we're suffering spiritually, still today, after 2,000 years of Golus, we are still manifesting the effect of Hashem's training system. By managing to maintain, yes, hundreds of thousands of people who are living at a level that is way above what the rest of the world can consider realistic. And they still have ideas for how we should be mechanech, by the way. They saw yesterday, they're coming to tell us how to be mechanech. They haven't figured it out. 60 years ago, they decided to drop the 3,000 year mahalak of chinuch, and they're still trying to put it together. Just this year, they cancelled one of the major, the Liba, whatever it is, what was it they cancelled this year? One of the main exam systems, because they decided it was having detrimental effects. Something that they were trying to push on us for so many years, and all of a sudden this year they decided Betzim it's not good for the whole chinuch system. So they're busy reconfiguring, and they're still sure that we should be doing it the way they did. Let's see them show some products, show some results. But whatever it is, we have to realize that these are all things, yes. Unrealistic comes from Hashem's initial standards of harshness for the purpose of, again, it was harshness that went against the backdrop of an awful lot of proximity that we don't see today. But for the purpose of creating this most perfect, this most excellent people. Okay, that's just in terms of putting in perspective the biblical standards that Hashem has towards the Jewish people. Now, we'll just take 2 more minutes, it's already late, 2 more minutes just to put into perspective, even though it might seem like the more difficult part, but where Sanhedrin goes and implements this, like we saw last week. So first of all, there's a big difference between what Sanhedrin did in the story of Pelegesh Begiva by deciding against, initially, on the destruction of the town of Giva, and then ultimately Shevet Binyamin, and what we've been describing here. It's a different story. We have to differentiate a very simple differentiation. Earlier we were talking about great people for very, very subtle faults being punished very harshly. Now we're not talking about that. We're talking about people at a serious lie. Now, people ask for 1 minute, how could they do it in such a big way? So first of all, we have to note that Hashem expected of the Jewish people to put in their own efforts to maintain these standards. It's like Hashem says, if you do it down on this earth, I don't have to do it. And therefore, yes, part of the Sanhedrin's job for the safety of the Jewish people was to ensure that these standards be upheld. If Hashem had to step in and take measures, that was dangerous. And therefore, yes, the Sanhedrin were meant to be learning Hashem's methods. They were meant to be analyzing their experiences from the Midbar and to see what Hashem would expect, and also more than that. If this was something we'd see happening every month with the Sanhedrin, it would be a little more difficult to explain. But what do we see? Something happened very early on in the settlement of Eretz Yisrael. A terrible thing, which basically resembles Manhattan. Right? But a terrible thing happened. It's Sanhedrin's job not just to figure out how you have to respond to this, But Sanhedrin have to figure out how do we ensure that this will not happen again for the next 800 years. This was their responsibility. So it's easy for us to come and say, couldn't they do it differently, etc. What does it take to guarantee that nothing of this sort will be repeated in the next 800 years? Now they didn't know it was 800 years. They were hoping it would be thousands of years. But they had to guarantee that there would be no such repeat thing. This was their responsibility towards the Jewish people. So as much rachmanis as they might have had on the women and children of Giva, they had to have a lot more rachmanis on the many more thousands of Jews who would be suffering terribly if these incidents would be repeated once every 100 years. How did they ensure that this meant they, you see, that they were successful? They took a very, very strong measure, and such an incident, never, with all their problems and criticisms that we see throughout biblical history, incident of this nature was never repeated. It worked. The Sanhedrin did what they had to do. So, yes, it sounds harsh at the time, but you can't just look at it in the perspective of the here and now. The Sanhedrin, we're talking about again, the 70 some odd greatest sages of the Jewish people, just figuring, I don't know this for a fact, but who are the members of that Sanhedrin? We're talking about names like Pinchas, Osniel ben Kenaz, and the great names of those early years in Eretz Yisrael. Right? These people were charged with the responsibility of take the 1,000-year perspective into the picture and reach a decision. This was the, what they were doing here. It's like Reb Shmuel Rozovsky, Rosh Yeshiva Panovich, and this, what this will end. Was once approached by a mother trying to get her son into the yeshiva, and he felt that this boy would be detrimental to the yeshiva. And she was sitting and weeping. And she said to him, how can you say no to a mother who's crying her eyes out? And his answer was, this is the answer of the God of the Yisrael. He said, I can't say no to a mother who's crying her eyes out. And in my mind's eye, when you're sitting here, I see 400 mothers on the other side of the table crying their eyes out just as dramatically, please don't accept this boy into my son's yeshiva. This is the achrayas that a God of Israel carries. In a much larger scale, this was the achrayas that the Sanhedrin carried. This is what they were dealing with when they were dealing with this parsha. This is the perspective on the story of Pilegesh Begiva, and in a broader way, this is really a perspective on understanding Nach in general. So this will be the every so often reminder, if we'll call it that. Bezos Hashem, let me just ask the Oilam. We start.